Jonathan Higham, curator of music and recorded sound at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, specializes in American music and recorded sound, with emphasis on 20th century music. He oversees one of the world's largest sound archives, which contains audio recordings and other materials that document the earliest days of recording through to today's digital media. He also curates and assists researchers with the extensive American Music Collection, which covers the full range of American music, from early manuscripts, scores, and sheet music, to the papers of major contemporary American composers, including the extensive John Cage Music Manuscript Collection. Most recently, he has produced a series of short videos that explore composer and sound artist Marianne Amiche's work through conversations as a shared engagement across social time and distance. Higham holds an MA in music history and literature from Boston University and a PhD in musicology from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So welcome to All Things Cage, Jonathan. How are you today?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to speak with you.
It's been really too long since I've seen you in person.
That's for sure. Maybe the last time I saw you was around the time Love Icebox came out.
That was 2019. I actually remember very fondly the time you came up. I'm not sure why you were there, but we were talking about, well, no, I don't know if there was a reason why you had come up or if you were just in the area. I think you were in the area looking at somebody else's collection or something, and you came over to visit, and we were saying that we really wanted to go through our John Cage manuscript collection and bump it up against our set in storage, because that was a nice clean copy, and just to clean ours up. And your eyes lit up, and you said, oh, could I help? And you're like you're my only friend who shares this clerical bent.
Well, it's, you know, I think as someone who's worked with the originals and a set of facsimiles that we use here at the Performing Arts Library for people, it gets a lot of use. And we've had it for a couple decades now. So it's been accessed many times. And, you know, no matter how careful people are, let's face it, some of that material isn't super cogent when you're looking at it in a folder, and if it gets out of place, and these things of course happen, you know, it's a little trickier. So I've always thought if there was a way to sort of, you know, reorient and survey and make sure everything is how it's supposed to be, that would be a good thing to do. And it's okay if there are problems. That's why we would do it, to get it all figured out and make sure people get the info. But yeah, because you've got, like, in the vault, so to say, this pristine set of copies, it's really the best thing to run up against what we have here. So I'd love to do that. I just think it's the responsible thing to do, but also a rare opportunity to really get the collection, you know, up to date, if you will.
Yeah. I was telling somebody about how that struck me as well as a kind of fun thing to do. And she looked at me very quietly and she said, you probably like to iron as well, don't you?
Well, I do believe the article that was published in Notes, which is the journal of the Music Library Association, that talked about preparing the manuscripts for their eventual arrival at the New York Public Library. I believe in the title of the article is Musicological Sweatshop. So I do think it is a kind of commitment.
The process of doing that, you know, I've talked about this a little bit, you know, was with a handful of people. So it was me, András Vilhelm from Hungary, Martin Erdmann from Germany, Paul van Emmerich from the Netherlands, and James Pritchett from Princeton at the time, and still in Princeton. And it was really fascinating to have all these countries represented in trying to make an organization of manuscripts of compositions by John Cage, which, as you well know, are not always clear-cut compositions. They're realizations of other works. They're maybe works that accompanied a dance, and that was it, and then they were lost. But there were, I can't tell you the number of fights that broke out between and among the scholars.
Sometimes the piece is a piece of correspondence. So, you know, it is.
It's written on hotel letterhead, the right. Instructions for the composition. Yeah. So anyway, it does have its jolly moments of, you know, liveliness. It's not all, you know, we're all scratching our heads with our 4-inch inch glasses, you know, trying to figure out things. So the audience knows who you are, not because you're a very visible person in the world, you know, like most of us, we all kind of work underground in a weird way, but our work touches a lot of people, you know, a lot of people are affected by the work that we do. And so they know that you are, you, Jonathan, and NYPL at the Performing Arts Library are home to Cage's music manuscript collection. So how much of your life is spent with the public? Let's start there. Do you, Jonathan, work a great deal with the public?
I do, and at different levels. So there are times where I will be right in a reading room, for example, and will encounter the public just cold at a reference desk. More often, however, I'm going out and meeting and connecting with people who have particular interests in our strengths. And what I mean by strengths are like, what are the services that we offer and what kinds of archives do we have? And so for example, I consider the public also live performances, going to concerts, going to events, and connecting people there with the resources the library has. It's now that makes it sound like I'm coming up to people and saying, have you got a library card? You know, the library will let you check out 40 CDs. You know, that's how I'm talking about. Talking more about helping people understand that in this sort of unique position that we have as a public institution with a public mandate to make otherwise somewhat rarefied materials available to the general public. That does take some work. You do have to go out and let people know that you're here and that these things are for them. So that I do have a lot of that action, concerts, events. I do things, you know, I still give talks at professional conferences, things like that. But really interacting with the public cold happens quite a bit. We have quite a few performances or public programs at the Performing Arts Library almost every day of the year. And so being at some of those throughout the year, it's always, you're just trying to connect people with what we have and understand what they're trying to do and all that. So yeah, I spend a fair amount of time with the public.
That sounds for sure. So I'm going to ask you some basic questions, the answers to which I'm not just leading you. I don't really know. Yeah. So when we made the music manuscript collection and then it ended up at NYPL, thankfully, we provided you with a copy with the originals, of course, which memory serves was 28,000 odd pieces of paper. And then we also gave you an archivally duplicated set, which we kept one. Actually, we kept two. I think you have one and we kept two, one in deep storage and then one that the John Cage Trust itself uses. And so when someone comes into the library and wants to access that collection, what are they accessing actually?
Right. It's a good question. And what they will be accessing first and foremost will be the what we call the service copies. So when you the John Cage Music Manuscript Collection is cataloged, what we call item level catalog. So each folder that has a manuscript or a set of sketches related to a manuscript has its own catalog entry, which is wonderful for getting a lot of detail and precision. It can be a drawback for researchers who are trying to see the totality of something in kind of one spot. And that's something actually we're thinking about rectifying as we go forward. But what you would find is a catalog record, and it would list what we call a class mark, that's the call number. And the ones that you first see in a John Cage manuscript record point you to the service copies. So as a researcher, you would make a request on site and a get handed into a desk, and a page goes and finds the box and brings it to you in the special collections reading area, where you can examine it under supervision. Occasionally, of course, the research needs go beyond just sort of consulting the image of a page. They're wonderful facsimiles, but there are limits to what you can see, of course. So there are plenty of occasions where we make them available to a researcher. Again, we'd like to know what it is, what kind of essentially what kind of risk are we assuming by exposing the originals, which are used so frequently that we do try and minimize that. But it's always for good reason. So you're going to come in and work with the facsimiles, and if there's a need or a reason, or if it's even really sometimes an important moment for somebody to see an original, and that we accommodate that. And so it's a pretty well-tuned system we have here, because we've been doing that too for a while.
Of course. Yeah. Are your public service copies holding up?
They are holding up. I think where we find, like we might have mentioned a little earlier, I would like to do a sort of survey of them to get them back. I know I wouldn't say they're really out of order, but I'd like to know that. So I'd like to go through and kind of put them together. Where the service copies don't serve as well, this is fine, they do a great job, but what the service copies are, for the most part, are uniform size, 8.5 by 11. So the actual manuscripts are all kinds of sizes. Sometimes there's onion skin music manuscript paper that's kind of a uniform size, but there's also anything he wrote on. And as Lori pointed out to me, he was a big recycler. There's all kinds of sizes and types of paper and things that he's written on that you can tell from the service copies, but you really can't get a sense of those items. So in other words, sometimes there's pieces of manuscript that skew artifact, skew object, if you will, that you don't quite get out of the service copies as much.
You remind me though, Jonathan, and maybe you've had this happen, but when we made the copies, the xerographic copies of the manuscript, we were faithful to copy both sides of the paper. If right. It was both sides of the paper, we were just faithful to everything. Yep. And I've had a couple of scholars make connections between what's on one side of the page and the other side of the page when they have nothing to do with each other. It was a recycled page. A big culprit was the Harvard lectures, mm-hmm. which was a huge book. It was produced in 1990 was when it was published, so 88 to 90. And it was these six long lectures, and they were misostics. And when you do misostics, I at the computer would generate the misostics, print them out. We're talking hundreds of pages. And then Cage would work with these copies, inserting the wing words, doing whatever, giving them back to me. I'd correct them, print out another set of hundreds of pages. And then we would use those as recycled paper, except that Cage, of course, would yank them out of the recycling box and write manuscript on them. So you have this skewed idea that the backside is the backside to the front side. Do you ever have that problem?
Well, to the extent that it would be known to us, it's tricky. I think an easy way for us to demonstrate that to people is that the version of 4 minutes and 33 seconds we have, in fact, the backside just has notes. Clearly he was on the phone, I want to say, taking some notes that are pretty obviously not related to the piece. And so that one is an easy way to demonstrate to people.
Be careful.
The back, yeah, there's literally phone numbers on the back. or recipes. There's plenty of recipes sort of tucked in the corners of his collection.
Of course.
Yeah, I where I find, I don't want to say mix-ups, but where people come, they're used to coming to an archive to find images or sketch material, or even the sort of holographic manuscript material. The ones that are the most baffling to people are any of the pieces that have transparencies, any of the pieces that have sort of where it's up to the performer to assemble the piece, so to say, by overlaying things, that can be very confusing for people because that actually is not how the manuscripts, you know, actually play out. Some of the things don't materialize till after.
Right. But also in the case of those pieces, isn't it even doubly confusing because the cutouts, if you will, are not cut out.
That's right. No, that's there's
a photograph or a Xerox of the cutout on a piece of paper.
Right. It's no, it is. It can be really tricky figuring
yeah.
out.
Yeah.
Figuring it
I can
out.
Imagine. Yeah.
But most of those have kind of surfaced, you know, we will see. So a good example of that is researchers and often, I guess, art museums who really do love John Cage's manuscripts, because certainly he had such an influence on the more traditional visual art world, but they're also just incredibly gorgeous. So many of them, his manuscript hand is outstanding and specific and wonderful. But a lot of times people will find images online of scores that don't necessarily exist as such, or will want the conductor's master score, the piano part for something for which there isn't a piano part, even if piano's in the title. You know, there are some tricky things like that.
Right, right.
That people don't necessarily know how much work they should put in to figure out what it is they want.
Yes, I agree. I have this happen all the time. We often get people sending me just one little notation from the concert for piano and orchestra, just yeah. one little thing, and say that they want to, you know, license the reproduction rights of this drawing by John Cage.
Right.
You know, to which I write back and I say, well, this is part of a score. This is actually, yeah. you know, no, I want this drawing. I want to use this drawing. I say, you don't know much about Cage's music, do you?
Right. And, you know, to be fair, that concert for piano is probably the trickiest one when it comes to serving that, because it's a massive complex of manuscript parts, but there isn't a score for it, right. per se. And that's what people want, is to see the whole score. And that's not really how that works. I think the trickiest one that we have in terms of regular or semi-regular requests that we get by email or phone or whatnot, asking for exactly as you say, oh, we'd love a copy of this. And you think, well, that it's not really how that works, but it's also hard to explain how that works.
So. Exactly. No, I know what you mean. It's actually kind of, there's something kind of cheerful about it, you know, because right. I mean, that, you know, that Cage was always one step ahead of us all and still is, you know, it's still tricky to try to explain some of the practices, some of the things that he did, that it's not three sentences. It's backing people up, you know, and I'm not talking about a lecture on conceptual concepts, you know, or concepts beyond conceptual art, you know, it's just really talking about what Cage did and how he thought about this.
Right, where you find a cactus, you know, things that are
right. What's a rattle, a pod rattle? What is that? You know.
Right. Yeah. It's a real treat to see how, you know, to be a little more esoteric, how the nature of his archival material does push against the norms of how people archive, and just as it did against a lot of other elements in his world, you know, standard musical practices, standard notation, what can be considered an instrument, all of these things. But he does push against the archive just as firmly, and yeah, I enjoy that. Of course,
there's no question in my mind that is the case. In my own experience in the music manuscript cataloging, we had difficulties of, you know, we had, you know, just metaphorically speaking, we had boxes on the floor, and this box was for this kind of music, and this box was for this kind, and we had more paper outside of those boxes than made it into those boxes, because there was no categorical way to deal with them. And then we realized we had to give up these categories in a way. We just had to deal with one score at a time. What was this about? What did the score do? What did it use? What were the instruments? You know, how could you organize this body of music, manuscripts, using whatever method, you know, whatever method you, and it turned out that we had to kind of invent our own.
Yeah, it's coupled with, or, you know, the challenges for researchers compounded with the fact that it's not, I don't know, if you're coming into, let's say, a pianist and you're coming in to learn some Chopin, well, there's this incredible recorded history that you can draw upon to help understand and learn that, should you choose. Recordings, when it comes to John Cage's music, and certainly many of those working around him and in his orbit, it's not the same. It's not the same reliable source for understanding. You absolutely do get a sense of interpretation, but it's a different experience. You're not going to really necessarily learn the piece in the same way. You don't learn necessarily John Cage's pieces by ear and look at the score in the same way. It's a different process. So it has been a wonderful challenge for us to help make the materials as sort of richly useful to the people that come in as possible, because we're certainly very accustomed to working with academic thinkers and writers and documentarians and essayists. Performers and interpreters, that's also a huge group of people that we serve. And of course, helping people understand John Cage's, you know, performance legacy and how to help them prepare is a different challenge, but it's a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, I agree. I always thought I remember a kind of aha moment I had many, many years ago now. But I remember this awareness that John Cage has prepared piano music as sheet music. It was the first time that I'd ever had a piece of music in my hand, a piece of sheet music to play, that looked entirely different than it would sound. You know? And I thought, what an amazing thing that is. Like, had I ever encountered a score that looked, I'm not talking about graphic notation or, you know, because those things are different, or the pieces that you were talking about with Cage, the pieces with, you know, moving parts that you toss on the floor and then arrange into a piece yourself. But I'm talking about a piece that looks perfectly notated, looks beautiful, looks like it could have come out of, you know, late Baroque almost. And except that when you play it, because it's for a prepared piano, it sounds nothing like what it looks like it should sound like. So no, gone is the experience as a wonderful musician. I don't know if you remember it as a young musician, the realization that you could look at a score and hear it in your head. Gone. That's like not possible with Cage's prepared piano pieces, because it doesn't sound like that. You will have no real idea until you play it.
Right. No, that's interesting. It's very true.
That's fun.
It's sort of like when you first are exposed to a keyboard synthesizer that you can program the keys to do animal sounds. So, you know, you can look at the score, but you really can't predict that cow chorus.
Exactly.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. That's really fascinating. You're right, because, you know, that's another interesting aspect of his archival materials, is that the earlier things do have a more recognizable, traditional, straightforward notation for lots of reasons that make sense. But you're right. Once he starts to change the medium to some extent, yeah, you don't know what you're going to get.
Right. Middle C is no longer middle C necessarily.
Right.
Middle C might be, but C sharp could be the sound of a chair scraping on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, or akin to that. It could be whatever the preparation was altering it to sound like, but it's no longer these pitches that you associate with a manuscript notation. Like, that means middle C. So it has, you know, something around 440 vibrations per second, you know.
Right. Except, yeah, it's
except it's all that's over, you know, all that is over with Cage's, with certain scores of John Cage, but not all of them. But it was just yet again, another sort of revelation about Cage's work when I discovered this. It's like, I don't think I'd ever seen that before in Western music, ever.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm right in thinking that you're a singer. I've definitely had things come out of my mouth that aren't what's on the page, but different kind of point of view, I suppose. So I'm trying to think of some other interesting interactions I've had with the manuscripts that, yeah, are different from what the experience would be with a published score. I remember having a fun discussion with folks from the Kronos Quartet, which had worked with him and had some pieces performed. And one of my favorites was showing them, I believe it's the piece I'm thinking of is called Quartet. Maybe that was what the Kronos commissioned.
Oh, the piece that Cage wrote for the Kronos?
Yeah.
Oh, no, right. No, that was 30 pieces for string quartet.
That's it. It's the 30 pieces.
Exactly.
Right. One of the pieces involves, you know, there's the visual aspect where you have a musical phrase, whatnot, where you have a period of time for which you have to complete that, right? So it can kind of work that way. But when I was talking to them, David Harrington in particular, about the piece, and I told him, well, in the manuscript collection, he actually worked on a lot of it out on graph paper. He, you know, David Harrington was like, well, I'd love to see that because we never saw any graph paper. You know, we're trying to think this in our head, where he's got graph paper where it's all subdivided up in his musical thinking.
Right,
and one of the things that David Harrington pointed out too was, as we were talking, he was looking at some of the figurations in his violin part and noticing that all of a sudden he remembered that these were supposed to be frog sounds. And I guess Cage had just been in, I guess, Costa Rica, perhaps, or Dominican Republic.
It was Puerto Rico. Yeah.
And
he was visiting his friend, Nelson Rivera.
Nelson Rivera. Okay.
Yeah.
And he had heard all of these great frog sounds, and he knew that, I guess, from some discussions, that David Harrington really liked frogs. And so these little figurations were based on frog sounds that he had heard. No one would have known that if David hadn't looked at that and those little figures and said, oh no, I'm remembering these are frog sounds now.
Yeah. So, they're famous in Puerto Rico. They're famous. They're little tiny frogs. They're everywhere. And they make this kind of chirpy sound, this beautiful little chirpy sound.
You know, there are wonderful aspects to the manuscript that are almost secrets, except for the few people that knew about them. So it's always a thrill when a set of performers who work directly with him do look at the score. So people like Joan LaBarbera or Margaret Langtam, because they can tell us things about a particular piece,
right.
Particularly how it was realized in performance that was the same or different from what was in the score.
Right.
And that's always an enjoyable encounter in the reading room.
It would be really fun. We don't have the space or the manpower to really do it, but it would be really fun to start a collection of interpreters' scores, you know, like all the people who have done aria. I would love to, Meredith Monk and Joan LaBarbera and anybody, you know, anybody who's done aria, to ask them for their score once they start performing it. Let me have it with their notes on it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's something that, especially aspiring performers would love to see how those things were handled.
It's one of my regrets is a heavy word, but it's in that direction of not pushing harder to get a performing edition of Cage going way back. You know, I'm talking about initiating this. Cage Trust was formed in 93. So I started making noises about this in 95, 96. Which 96, of course, is when David Tudor died. So that was the first loss of somebody who could really help with all these different kinds of scores that he had a hand in actually making first realizations of them or first performances of them. So it's just too bad. You know, you were talking about pianists coming in and wanting to learn about interpretive history of pieces. We don't have those people around us anymore. in the Cage world. So it's just too bad. There's my regret for the day.
It doesn't have to be, it can be more of an open call.
Yeah. It would be a big undertaking, you know, and especially, well, we have people who worked with or under people that maybe could bring that forward, some of that knowledge forward. I don't know. It's just something I wish we had. You know, we have, you know, any good Schubert player has a favorite edition. You know, they have the, you know, whatever, the Czerny edition or the whatever. Right. But we don't have that with Cage. We just have a score and somebody's saying, what am I supposed to do with this?
You know, it makes me think of another, like a story you told me, and I have to put you on the spot, but when you were doing research for the exhibition in Lyon that you worked on, and you told me the wonderful story about, as you were going through a lot of the scores in the collection that people haven't spent a lot of time with, frankly, you know, in a lot of that period. And there's a lot of prose and a lot of handwriting in that. And you told me the story about figure out why his handwriting got really weird in one spot. And you thought it might have to do with him trying to write with his left hand. Is that
yes?
Remember this story?
Could
you tell me? Share it with us.
That it was basically that. You know, I remember him doing this. It was a piece that dated from, I want to say 84 or 85, something like that. And I think that he had either broken his wrist or sprained his wrist. And so he was writing with his left hand. And that had to be it because everybody was sitting around. It was you. I think Ben Schiff was with me. There were a couple of people. And this, by the way, for our audience, I was looking into manuscripts for a show that I curated in the Museum of Contemporary Art in Lyon called Cage's Suttee. So it was going to be a composition for museum, which I'd borrow, of course, from Roly Holy Over a Circus, composition for museum. Same idea, but bringing all these materials relating to works by John Cage that had anything to do with Satie, leaned on Satie's texts, used vexations, the melody as a, you know, conscious firmus, whatever. And there I was with Jonathan, and we were looking at all these really kind of esoteric things that people don't perform a lot or that aren't, that are part of poetic collections, but aren't really used as music so much. And there was John Cage's hand almost backwards. It was almost, yeah. So again, yes, it's the same thing. We were talking in a show I recently did with James Pritchett. We were talking about Morton Feldman's little known trio arrangement of Cage's Cheap Imitation. And he had seen the original score, which Morty Feldman had given to Aki Takahashi, the pianist. And he said it was covered with cigarette burns because Morty Feldman was constantly smoking. So when he worked, he had lit cigarettes that were constantly dropping on the manuscript. So it has little burn marks all over it. You
know? Yeah.
I suppose there will be a time in our, you know, in our post-cigarette world where nobody will know what those little marks are. You know,
there are quite a few cigarette burns. The Williams mix has a number of them, famously.
I wonder if that was Morty as well. I mean, John was certainly a smoker at that time. Yeah. If he and Morty together.
I don't know. It sounded like it was always hard for him to get other people to help him work on the Williams mix.
Yeah, I think Earl Brown was always game.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Another sort of fun story that is reflected here at the library that's not in the manuscripts is, you know, there's the famous story that Morton Feldman and John Cage met in 1950 at the New York Philharmonic concert and were both astounded by Webern's symphony, Opus 21, and, you know, walked out both astounded and met. I assume that story is true. I don't know.
But. Yes, but the real part of the story was they loved it. They both loved it. They were not together. And then on the program was a Rachmaninoff piece. And they both walked out in disgust because they didn't want to hear Rachmaninoff. They didn't want the Rachmaninoff intruding upon their euphoria over the Webern.
Well, it's funny because one of the things I like, there's a letter where John Cage's writing about the Webern Symphony and saying the only place he was able to find a score was at the New York Public Library. And indeed, I went and found what would have been the score that he would have, they would have consulted. We still have it sitting in the cabinet. So anyone wants to see the score that he was sending people to look at, because
interesting. Was this a pocket score? Was it like the conductor?
No, it's a large score. You know?
Really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's bound.
It's a small orchestra, right?
It's a bound score. Anyhow, it's here. So there's nothing on it that would tell you that, right? But we do have these documents.
Right.
As a library patron, he was using. I think he did use the library quite a bit.
He definitely did. I remember for your operas 1 and 2, when he was creating the orchestral score, he was drawing upon the scores that were in the collection at NYPL, at the Performing Arts Library, yeah, to use as, because his whole idea about your operas 1 and 2 in the future would be that people use, it was like the first recycled opera, that they used the collections that they had available to them. You wouldn't create new costumes. You would throw chance operations against whatever costumes you had in the back and use those. And you would put together a score based on the orchestral scores that you had in your library. So you didn't have to buy more or rent more, you know?
Right. Oh, that's fun. Yeah. I like to remind people that, you know, we've been here a long time, and even our office files have letters and reference questions from a lot of people that are always seen as almost held up as these sort of artists, but they have to do their research and listen to their recordings and find all this stuff too. And there's this just a very fun history here of him and others coming in and using the materials, having concerts.
Absolutely. NYPL is probably one of the, you know, it is one of the jewels of New York for that very purpose.
Yeah.
But I remember when back to your operas, when we were doing the research for the costumes, all of that research was done at the Fashion Institute of Technology, all of it, you know. It took about 2 solid weeks and we got what we needed. Yeah. But you had to go somewhere that would house those kinds of materials. Where else are you going to go?
I don't know. No, it's amazing what, as a city, New York is kind of pieced together. You know, we all try and do our best in our areas, but we can't all do everything. So, you know, we do sort of work informally together, complementing things and then learning where to send people. So, you know, for the listeners, I mean, maybe Laura, you could kind of explain how John Cage's materials are dispersed over a couple different institutions. Because while we have nearly, not every, but the overwhelming majority of the music manuscripts.
You have, I would say, 99.
Yeah, there's maybe just a handful kicking around out there.
Yes, we still have a box that we have to get over to you at some point of things that you don't have that have surfaced over the last, 18 years?
Yeah.
Since the more, 28.
More than that, 28. Sorry, yeah.
28. So the collection was amassed, cataloged, duplicated, and sent off to NYPL in 1994, I guess it would have been, maybe 93, late 93. But so in the intervening 28 years, pieces of paper have popped up in odd places, stuck in the back of a flat file, in the back of a book, stuck to some Xeroxing that had been done of an article. You know, anyway, we have, I'd say a good archival box of materials. But there are other things that are in private collections that were sold in very lean times. There were things that Cage had given as gifts to collectors who were philanthropically inclined toward him or toward Merce Cunningham. So there are a few things, but yeah. So NYPL is the obviously the principal place that anybody goes for research into Cage's music manuscripts, no question. NYPL has the added benefit of it being connected, it also having this enormously relevant dance collection, relevant to the Cage collection. With Merce's passing in 2009, you now have the corner on the Cage Cunningham world by having those two collections in one place. And then the John Cage Trust is a kind of catch-all We are situated up at Bard, so we're a little ways outside of New York City. We do maintain a copy of the manuscript collection, but it is only for research purposes. So someone can look at it there, but they can't copy it. They can't have permission to use it, but they can see it. They can see what's available. And if they want anything, then we send them down to Jonathan. Plus, because NYPL is a library, you also have, like the Cage Trust, a library. So you have anybody working there has access to books, anything published by Cage, about Cage. Odds are good that you're going to have it, as we do. But then you have, what else? We've got Northwestern University. Northwestern is where the correspondence collection is held, which is an enormously important collection. They also have all of the materials, including the manuscripts themselves, of the notations collection that was in the 1960s with Alison Knowles primarily and Dick Higgins. Cage started up a collection of manuscripts from composers all around the world. And most of it was published in the end in a book called Notations. And all of that manuscript is at Northwestern. Then you have the archives at Wesleyan University, because Wesleyan was Cage's first publisher. So anything having to do with Cage's books, manuscript-wise, would be in the special collections at Wesleyan University. And I myself have found things at Wesleyan that I didn't even know existed, because Cage would, from time to time in the preparation of a book, he would give to his editor, you know, a stack of 20 pieces that he had produced over the years, only maybe 14 of which would be chosen. And Cage never took the other six back. So those six are sitting there. Then I've blogged a couple of them over the years because they're just so charming. When he addresses the Wesleyan Glee Club is probably my favorite. He was so funny. He was just such a funny person. And what else? What am I missing? Have I missed any of the big guys?
I think that's the big stuff. And, you know, I appreciate you sharing that, because I, you know, like to help researchers when they come here, mm-hmm. you know, make sure they know where things are.
And by the way, Jonathan, I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. just to clarify that the Wesleyan collection has a finder's aid. So that's online. So that's very, very useful. We don't really have a finder's aid, but we do have catalogs that are more and more online. Our visual art catalog is coming up any day now. So for our permanent collection, we have a rough cut text manuscript collection, Finder's Aid, which is not available outright to people, but we do make it available to serious inquirers who are working on text pieces. Yours is available. Northwestern is available. So more and more, the materials that are in our holdings are at least identified as being held where we are. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it wasn't always that way.
No, and the database that is maintained on the trust website, johncage.org, does a great job at helping people track the location of the music manuscripts, for sure, and adds a lot of information detailed that isn't always necessarily in our catalog record. So I like to also make sure people are jumping around. You know, another thing I'd mentioned too, and you put it well, it's saying, well, having the manuscript collection situated at the library is wonderful for researchers because of all of the secondary literature available, as well as the direct ties with, the Merce Cunningham Archive, which is massive and wonderful and really well described. I'm very fond of the audio recordings, probably the single largest batch of John Cage archival recordings that you can get at somewhere, and they're really well taken care of. And I also point out, going forward, as we continue to collect and you know, American music and post-war experimental music, increasingly the folks in which the circle in which John Cage worked, those archives are here. So Christian Wolff's papers are here, and you can sort of see those connections. Alvin Lussier's papers are here. There's the connections in there. And that's one of my favorite examples, because the score for the piece Rozart Mix from
which, by the way, we're doing a project with Rozart Mix this fall.
Oh, you know, it's wonderful, because that's one of my favorite sort of John Cage, sort of Alvin Lussier, also mind-bending kind of things to think about, which is the published score for that piece is in large part the epistolary exchange between Alvin Lussier and John Cage talking about a piece they want to do at the Rose Art Museum at Brandeis. And what's really interesting about it is it really defies the notion of an original document. So on one hand, the original like notogram or piece of paper that has something about the piece sent to him, it's the photocopy that gets incorporated into, you know, the published work. And so it's sort of fun to see what constitutes the original material for that score. Photocopies and originals are in play. And it's just fun to try and baffle that out in your mind.
Yeah, I remember when we sort of did that for the first time with C.F. Peters, our publisher, where we didn't have a lot that represented a piece, but there was a lot of interest in the piece. And so we ended up publishing the scribbled notes on a flyer, because that was what constituted the closest thing we had to a manuscript.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a bunch of things like that, of course. I remember a number of years ago, you know, helping to identify this haiku that was kind of buried in some sketches, and we had to blow it up. We had to go to our designer because it was so faint and hard to read that our in-house designer helped us blow it up onto a big piece of architectural paper and a giant scroll, which we then sent off to C.F. Peters. So that's a lot of fun. Oh, and Laura, one thing, just for informational purposes, one thing that researchers can often, and this is an important thing, I think, for people who are trying to date things, which is, you know, Henmar publishing. What should they know about that? As opposed to C.F. Peters?
I would never answer such a question.
Okay.
That's a question you'd have to put that to Gene Capriolo. Okay. I'm sure there's an official line that goes
Got with it. This. Well, I mention it only because those things that are dated, things dated that were written before it published in that early form, are dated at the point of publication and not at the composition often. And that can be confusing for people who are relying on those dates.
No, I think everything before the signing of a contract with the publisher got lumped under the same date.
Yeah.
It's not the date of composition at all. It's the date of copyright transference, if you will. It's a legal sort of move. But I don't want us to hang up, so to speak.
Yeah.
But at least mentioning the fact that you have a new collection that came in. It's not so new, but it's been a couple of years now, but you have now the Evakian collection, the manuscript collection. And this is fantastic for John Cage. Evakian being the producer of the 25-year retrospective concert that John Cage gave at Town Hall, which really was his first foot into the solid world of celebrity in New York City.
Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, George Evakian is just an incredible figure in American music as a major jazz producer.
Exactly.
He had produced records, Louis Armstrong, Miles Davis, Duke Ellington, all of that. And he was also very proudly Armenian and was very tied to Armenians. And he married into another Armenian family.
The Ajemians.
Anahid Ajemian and her sister Maro Ajemian, who were major champions of new composition and were very close in that regard with John Cage, who wrote dedicated one of his most famous, Maro Ajemian.
Which we played a little bit of on a previous program.
Oh, wonderful. But that collection, because it's also Anahid's materials, is filled with correspondence. I believe there are some letters in the volume you edited, Laura, that came from there. But George Evakian's real commitment to putting out the town hall recordings, fascinating, because one, he foot the bill for it and did it as a live recording. It's the first LP set really that has liner notes, and that's in recorded sound history. That's not—
Yes, and all the, by the way, I mean, also, Jonathan, doesn't it, if memory serves, it comes with reproductions, manuscript reproductions, or reproductions.
It's an incredible set of liner notes. And, just for those who want to get an introduction to John Cage, those liner notes do serve both to talk about the pieces and help sort of contextualize them and understand them, but it really is a little treasure trove of images, of manuscript materials, photographs.
And scores, actual
and
scores.
Yeah.
You met him, right? You met Avakian.
Yes, yeah, we worked with him quite a bit. He lived quite a long time, and we were very fortunate to work with him on the acquisition of his collection and Anahid, both of them. You know, he had a great memory. He really just loved music and all kinds of music and really supported those things he really thought were important. And yeah, that early, I wouldn't call it early for John Cage, it wasn't early in life, but he was relatively young. And as you said, really gave him some celebrity. Of course, Town Hall was really the stomping ground at that period in time. Town Hall, Carnegie Hall, where you would have to make your name. It's a wonderful set of recordings too that really captures the live experience for those.
It's true.
And the audience participation as well is appropriately captured on those recordings.
Yeah, I love the show that you guys did, by the way, of that collection, that small show that you did, and whatever that, what year was that? 2018?
Maybe earlier than that, actually.
17.
And George Avakian, you know, visited and had a wonderful.
Yeah.
Time, but that was a great exhibition. It was really put together by my colleagues, Matt Snyder, who was one of George Avakian's personal assistants in managing his archive and works at the library as an archivist. Robert Boswick, my predecessor and as chief of the music division, and Jessica Wood, our assistant curator, did a lot of work in putting that together and really making all the pieces work. But it really was a wonderful journey through music history, American music history.
I loved it. I remember walking through it and walking through it again because it was just so fun. Because it wasn't a huge show, but every piece in that show was beautiful, an amazing object to look at.
Yeah, and just dense. And when you see these sort of people, again, not behind the scenes is the right word, but to some extent, the people who are music together, putting all of the recording, putting that together. And you see that American music does have all of these ties to itself, whether it likes it or not. Back there, you know, the strings behind the tapestry are all kind of being put together by people who love music or love making money or both or whatever, but the small world back there. And it's nice to see it come together in a way that doesn't give us the choice of deciding what exactly is music.
It's true. Jonathan, we're going to have to close so we can leave a little bit of time for music today.
Yes.
Thank you so much. If you'd like, we can do this again anytime.
Anytime. It was a real treat. And I, you know, aside from just the joy of speaking, I do think, you know, Laura, folks in sort of privileged positions like ours, when it comes to sort of engaging with our cultural heritage, also have an obligation to tell the stories that we experience and
it's true. It's
the anecdotes and the fun things as well, because that I feel, you know, we sort of have that responsibility. There aren't that many of us. So I appreciate the opportunity to share those stories with the wider public. And
great. I appreciate how much you're doing it. We'll talk again, Jonathan. Thank you. Take care of yourself. And I hope to grab an espresso with you sometime soon.
Please. All the best. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
William's Mix is a 4-minute, 15-second work for 8 tracks of 1/4-inch magnetic tape. The 193-page score, unpublished but held in the John Cage Music Manuscript Collection at NYPL, is a pattern for the cutting and splicing of sounds recorded on tape. The approximately 600 sounds created fall into 6 categories: city, country, electronic, manually produced, wind, and small sounds, which require amplification. The compositional means included I Ching chants operations. Cage made a realization of the work in 1952 into 1953 with the assistance of Earl Brown, Louis and B.B. Baron, David Tudor, Ben Johnston and others, funded by the work's dedicatee, the architect Paul Williams. Pre-signifying the development of algorithmic composition, granular synthesis, and sound diffusion, Williams' Mix was the third of 5 pieces in Cage's larger project for music for magnetic tape, works that date from 1951 to 1954. It premiered at the 25-year retrospective concert of the music of John Cage on May 15th, 1958 at New York's Town Hall, where it was recorded by Columbia Records producer George Avakian and subsequently issued by him on a 3-LP set.
Thank you.